I want to know is, do you want some time to attempt to work out with fiscal something that you think is more accurate before we act on this, or would you prefer we act on this and you're anticipating a referral at least on 2376 to the Ways and Means Committee?
Mr. Chair, if I might inquire, what is the threshold for the referral that we're talking
50.
About? 50. Well, I would think it would be appropriate for us to have some conversation with Legislative Fiscal.
Okay. Then what I would recommend is that we not move this bill today, or we could move it to the full, because the full is going to have to attach the referral. So after we'll hear the witnesses from the state, obviously next on this issue, and then if the determination is we want to move forward, we'll move it forward and then hold it in full until you've determined, you've worked out with Fiscal what you can work out. And then we'll attach a referral if we need to. Any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to get Kathy's name wrong, but Kathy is from the State Offices of Services for Children and Families. If she would come forward, because I can't read your last name.
Ledesma.
Well, I couldn't have said it right if I could have read it. So.
Thank you, Chair Williams. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Program Manager for Adoption Services for the State Office for Services to Children and Families. And we did prepare separate testimony on each of these two bills. And so instead of reading that testimony, in both of those pieces of testimony, you do have that in front of you. I will tell you from the outset that, and I'm sure it will come as no surprise, that because the legislation, either of these pieces of legislation, is in the governor's budget, we are opposing both of those pieces of legislation. Before I get into some of my prepared testimony, I just had made available to me the juvenile department director's testimony this morning. I'm very confused by what it is that they've presented in their testimony. To the best of my knowledge, in termination of parental rights cases, the payment for the witnesses and for the publication actually comes directly out of the budget that I administer out of my program, and I pay that to the Attorney General on our interagency agreement. So I'm very confused, and we will have to have some conversation with them to see, make sure what we're talking about here. So in our estimation of the $112,000 that you got from Legislative Fiscal, that does not include the fees associated with termination of parental rights cases. It only includes fees associated with other dependency matters. So obviously we do have to have a conversation about this. We also believe that the juvenile departments do share responsibility for getting witnesses in juvenile dependency cases to the court, and therefore philosophically would disagree as well. However, our primary reason for opposing both these bills is that they are not included in the governor's budget.
Mr. Chair.
Question, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me see if I got this straight. You disagree with the bills because you think that your department already pays the cost that these bills are suggesting you should pay.
Representative Bowman, members of the committee, yes and no. it's a difficult question. We have four separate kinds of fees in these two bills.
Right.
Each bill represents a different classification of fees, and then within each of those two classifications, there are termination of parental rights cases and there are other dependency cases. In our calculation of the cost, what we were calculating would be the additional cost to SOSCF for dependency cases in which the witnesses are summoned, summons have to be prepared, or publications, say, for parents in order to appear. So I was confused this morning when I saw that they also included termination of parental rights, because that is in our legal assistance budget already. And that was an administrative action that was done several years ago that we just started paying for that through our interagency agreement with the Attorney General.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So you're paying a fee to the Attorney General for what service is the Attorney General providing that you're paying that fee to him for?
Well, they provide several fees, Representative Ullman, several services for us. One of those services is to publish for absent parents in termination of parental rights proceedings.
Thank you,
continue.
Mr. Chair. No, I'm done. I'm really confused now. Thank you.
Representative Wilson. Thank you. Question I would have is the other types of dependency cases. What would be the rationale for the counties continuing to pay for those, if I'm understanding this correctly?
Chair Williams, Representative Wilson, the rationale would be that the juvenile department does share the responsibility for making sure that witnesses do appear in proceedings concerning children.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Kathy?
Yeah.
Yeah, Representative Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just as confused as Representative Bowman, and I have I'm not sure which one of these has the fiscal impact. It was my understanding it was indeterminate on HB 2377. Meaning
yes.
There is none, or we can't figure out what it is?
No, I think there is an acknowledgement that there is some fiscal impact, but it's indeterminate because it's dealing more with expenses that can't be clearly identified. The number of summonses and for witnesses is something that they can actually count and get a better handle on, and that's how they get to, I think, a more determinate fiscal impact.
Okay. Well, the question I had was Ms. Ledesma opposed both bills because they're not in the governor's recommended budget, but if we don't have a fiscal impact on one of these, which is indeterminate, do you still oppose it?
Representative Walker, Chair Williams, members of the committee, that is correct. We oppose it. We know that there will be some fiscal impact, and because the legislation was not included in the governor's budget, was not anticipated, even if that cost were to be $1, we would have to oppose it.
Right. I understand that part. All right. Thank you.
Kathy, I guess I'm going to go back and maybe plow some ground that Representative Bowman did, because I'm a little confused, I guess, as well. And it's the relationship that you've identified with the Attorney General's office and what services you were paying to them. It sounds like you read the testimony from the Juvenile Directors Association as suggesting that they're paying costs that you think you're paying. Is that am I right at that point?
Chair Williams, you're absolutely correct.
Okay. So if they are paying those costs, and you're paying those costs, then somebody's getting paid twice.
I would agree with that.
Okay. All right. So that's one issue that seems to me that needs to be cleared up. Secondly, I guess I'd like to know from your position, and I know you stated it a little bit, but I want to understand a little bit more about your underlying rationale for why you think in these cases this ought to be a budget item. I recognize your position that it's not in the governor's budget, therefore we haven't anticipated it, therefore we don't want to own it. But I guess I want some rationale for why you think that this is something that the county juvenile departments ought to be required to pay. I mean, is there a rationale other than your agency just isn't anticipating it, or is there a real policy reason to keep that cost there?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, just before I came up to the microphone, Nancy and I were looking at the juvenile code. There are some provisions in juvenile code which really outline, Nancy will bring that up. And again, I'm not terribly prepared to talk about this. We just had this discussion just before I came to the microphone. 419A, 012, duties of director or counselor. The director of a juvenile department or one of the counselors shall, one, make or cause to be made an investigation of every child brought before the court and report fully thereon to the court, two, be present in court to represent, three, furnish such information and assistance as the court requires. It is the court requiring these witnesses to be there. And four, take charge of any child before or after the hearing. So it would be on number three that we would be hanging our hat here.
That the court requires them to be there?
The court would require them to be there.
And that's the county's responsibility because?
Yeah. Because it the statute says that is the duty of the director of the juvenile department.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. I get where you're headed. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I was wondering if we would bring the county representatives back up so that we can ask them if they have the same understanding of
okay.
who's paying for what
Great.
That we've been presented with.
Great. Kathy, why don't you stay there as well? Do you have questions?
I could.
If you'd like to... Question, please feel free.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've heard the testimony that was just presented. What do you think of that testimony?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Representative Bowman, it's our understanding that there continue to be cost of terminal parental rights cases that are borne by the counties, and it may well be that there was an administrative change in policy by the state, but as we know with a lot of other things, practices from county to county vary, and it may be some counties they're paying for it and some counties they're not, and that could just be because the word didn't get down or because the bills continue to be sent even though the practice has changed. I can't really speak to that, but what we do know is that we continue to get bills, and it's our understanding that they do include termination of parental rights cases. The other thing I just might add on the point about our responsibility, it is true that under the juvenile code, juvenile departments are a party to juvenile dependency cases. And the statute that was quoted is in fact the case. The practice, however, has been over the last 20 years for judges to direct juvenile departments to focus on delinquency matters while SCF focuses on dependency matters. So in most counties, not all, most counties in the state, juvenile departments do not appear in dependency hearings, do not participate in termination of parental rights hearings, and focus exclusively on juvenile delinquency hearings. In a small number of counties, there are still juvenile department staff who do appear on dependency cases.
Mr. Chair, Hello? I might.
Yeah.
Miss, I'm sorry, would you say your last name again?
Ledesma.
Ledesma. Ms. Ledesma, if what you've heard is accurate, clearly the administrative change that took place internally wasn't broadly distributed. Will you be able to let us know when that administrative change took place so that we can find out if, in fact, how many counties are still paying a bill that you have administratively said is inappropriate for them to pay?
Representative Bowman, members of the committee, I would be more than happy to come back and let you know when that change took place. Frankly, I would be surprised that there would be county-specific differences because our contract or our interagency agreement with the Department of Justice is a statewide agreement, and that's a statewide administered program. It's unlike any other program that the State Office for Services to Children has in that it's a centrally based, centrally operated, centrally administered program, and all of that billing goes through our office. So it's not a billing that would go out from the local branch to the county juvenile department. It is through the central office.
I guess I'm still a little confused. I have one last question, and if I'm still confused, I'll just have to live with that. The county says they receive bills and they pay those bills, and those bills come from your department and they pay the bill to your department. You say you send bills to the Department of Justice. You say that to the Attorney General's office. You provide a fee to the Attorney General's office for the service that they provide. Is that correct? Right?
That's correct.
Okay. So, I'm still not understanding how the county can be paying bills that you're not sending, and they don't have to pay because administratively you've changed the statute, but you have people sitting on both sides of you that are saying that they are paying bills that they are receiving for services that you have stated that you are paying the Attorney General to provide.
I understand your confusion. I too am confused by that, and I think what's called for here is some conversation among us before we come back and talk with you.
I definitely agree. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Ackerman.
Maybe I can follow up with Representative Bowman's process question here. isn't it correct that these bills are not related to the payment of, you know, legal fees by the Attorney General? These are the out-of-pocket expenses that are borne by either some parties in these proceedings to bring witnesses to court or to properly summon witnesses through delivery of summons or publication of summons. We're really just talking about out-of-pocket costs, aren't we? I'm talking about professional fees that you may charge back.
Representative Ackerman, I'm not sure I understand your question completely. I do know that as part of our what we pay to the Department of Justice, to the family law section that handles termination of parental rights cases for us, are a number of things. One would be doing publishing for parents based on affidavits that are prepared, search affidavits that are prepared by the State Office for Services to Children and Families, and we provide those to the Department of Justice, and they publish, to the best of my knowledge, and they bill us for that.
And you bill back to the county?
To the best of my knowledge, we don't bill back to the county because that shows as a budget item for us.
But that's only in termination proceedings.
In termination proceedings. In dependency proceedings, I can't speak directly to that. That's not a part of the program that I manage. However, those would be relatively few and minor in comparison to termination of parental rights cases.
I think what we probably would need then is how you're tracing these costs. What costs are you reimbursed that may be incorporated within this bill? I have just a second observation as to the county's obligation. We'll sort of switch, and I'm just going to suggest a historical perspective, and you can just let me know if I'm right, but many, many years ago, well, not too long ago, all the court systems were under county jurisdiction for the payment of judicial salaries and expenses. That responsibility has now shifted to the state. Would I be right in asserting that perhaps the obligation of the county to pay is just based upon this historical development, which has not evolved? That is where, what I mean to say, the county has never been obligated, the state's never been obligated to pick up these expenses because it's been a county function for so long, even though now our state courts are, our courts are state, are administrated by the state. Is there any historical perspective there that's correct?
If I may, Representative Ackerman, Mr. Chair, that's how it was explained to me, is that it did relate to the shifting of the responsibilities and could have very well been an oversight. I would like to comment, however, I think it's important that, you know, it may be that using motion to terminate parental rights was simply a poor example. This was may have been a particular case. The true underlying issue is, and you stated it correctly, is that the juvenile departments are in fact paying for juvenile dependency proceedings, the publications, and the witness fees thereof, whereas the juvenile departments have no role in determining who is to be subpoenaed, who is to testify, what publications to use, and if it's done properly or if it's not. In essence, and I think I provided a specific example in there, in essence, when an error is made, the juvenile department is obligated to pay the bill, but has no way of correcting why the mistake was made. And and further, if I may make a final comment, I believe when the chairman commented on the mid-sized county that pays the $7,000, I believe that might be my county. And to put things in perspective, the cost of publications in Linn County is about the $7,000. The cost of witness fees, we only budget for $500, so it's really a big difference there. And again, because I have no control or tracking of those cases, it's simply a guess for me when I put in the budget, you know, how much SCF or how many publications SCF might do the following fiscal year.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I might offer, for us to go back and work with SCF and clarify these questions in terms of which hearings and which expenses so that the committee has that knowledge. And just to add in addition to that, irrespective of whether termination of parental rights cases hearings or other dependency hearings, it's still a question of counties being required to pay for hearings that were very only marginally related to, and it's really a state agency's role dealing with these cases, whichever they turn out to be.
Okay, I appreciate your suggestion. We would be very pleased to have you go back and sort of communicate to help lessen our confusion, and maybe even that of your own, collectively. What might be helpful when you come back to talk to us is to provide us maybe on a one page the kind of hearings that are being effective, who gets to really decide whether those do or don't take place, and then maybe across that page, who bears the responsibility fiscally for it, and some statutory references. I sort of have a grid in mind as to how that might look. Any other questions for these witnesses before I close the public hearing on these two bills? So with that, we will now close the public hearing on House bills. I've lost my script here. 2377 and 2376. Thank you. And thank you very much. It was at least interesting this morning. That was nice. I am now going to open the work session on House Bill 2092. Mr. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2992 states that an individual commits aggravated murder if the individual intentionally kills a victim who was a juror or witness before, because the victim was a juror or witness in official proceedings. You may remember this bill from last week. The Court of Appeals decided, in interpreting the statute, interpreted criminal proceedings not to include juvenile proceedings. In the middle 80s, the Supreme Court, addressing the same issue, determined that a criminal proceedings did include a juvenile proceedings. And what happens is between then and there, we had the PGE v. Volley, where the court now looks more towards text and context rather than going to legislative history. And that criminal proceedings is, in the view of the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, excluded juvenile proceedings. You have before you the dash two amendments. We're in keeping with the discussion we had the last time. Official proceedings is very broad. It's a proceedings before any judicial, legislative, or administrative body or officer, wherein sworn statements are received, includes any referee, hearing examiner, commissioner, notary, or other person taking sworn statements in connection with such proceedings. Which you have before you, the dash two amendments, they are in line with the amendments that you, rough amendments that you had me pass out of the last hearing. And basically it states that a victim was a juror or a witness in a criminal proceedings or a witness in a juvenile proceedings under 419C005, and that's a juvenile delinquency proceedings, which would be the equivalent for a juvenile of adult criminal proceedings. And the murder was related to the performance of the victim's official's duties as a juror or witness. As used in the subsection, witness means a person who has testified in a criminal proceeding or juvenile proceedings under RS 419C005 or a person. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this language comes from the Maney case. And let me give you for the record the citation to that case. It would be ORS 297-620, and that language that the court's mentioned is, or a person who knows or is expected to know material facts about the crime or the act committed by a juvenile and has been or is likely to be summoned to testify about those facts at some stage of the proceeding.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Do the committee members have questions for Mr. Taylor about the amendment? Its language. I don't see Mr. Castagna. Oh, there he is. Do you have the... you don't have it? Okay. Mr. Castagna had some material which he was just going to have distributed to the committee. I'll leave the record open even at the close of the work session, so if you'd like to get that distributed into the record, we'll be happy to accommodate you. Any other comments or discussion? I'd like to actually take just a second and... do you have ORS 297-620?
Mr. Chair, I do have it before me. I have the downloaded from Westlaw, so I can't really, let's see. I think it would be at page 626 of that opinion. and it'd be the sentence right here. Therefore, a witness to a criminal proceedings for or has testified at some stage of a criminal proceedings, and someone who knows or is expected to know material facts of a crime is likely to be summoned to testify about these facts at some stage of the criminal proceedings.
Okay, so just so I understand that, that was the Supreme Court case. That was the Manny case, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so that language in the amendment comes directly from the Supreme Court's analysis of what constitutes a witness in this case in either a criminal or a juvenile proceeding.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. What this the bill does and the amendment does is it would, because of PJB Boley, it would be possible to court, and looking at this statute again, would also say that you had to be a witness in the past tense, and not because you're dead, but because you've already testified.
Mm-hmm.
What the Manny case said is that it applies not only to someone who has been summoned, but someone who knows or is expected to, and is likely to be summoned to testify about those facts. So it would apply to someone who was murdered because they were going to testify, as well as someone who has testified. It would also apply to someone who is a witness in a juvenile proceedings, a juvenile delinquency proceedings, as opposed to a juvenile proceedings which would include dependency and juvenile delinquency. This would not include dependency. It includes only juvenile delinquency.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
Well, and I assume that from this language in the amendment relating to the murder being related to the performance of the victim's official duties, that presumes knowledge on the part of the murderer of the witness's knowledge or status,
right,
as a witness.
Right.
So that the murder is perpetrated in connection with that knowledge.
With that necessary
knowledge.
Intent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
I would move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2092.
Representative Wilson moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2092. Any discussion? Any objection? Amendments adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
I would move House Bill 2092 as amended to the full committee.
Representative Wilson moves House Bill 2092 to as amended to the full committee with a
do pass.
With a do pass recommendation. Any comments? Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, I did not object to the movement of the amendment, but as is normally the case, it's really hard to make bad public policy better. And if we've all been watching what's been happening across the nation, what we find is that the death penalty in many cases should not have been imposed. And in many cases over the last 5 years, there's been lots of people who have been released because of new technological advances like DNA testing that have proved those people not only should not have been on death row, but they really should not have been found guilty. There are many states that are moving towards a moratorium on the death penalty, and because this is clearly an expansion of our interpretation of death penalty law in Oregon, I am going to be in opposition to this measure.
I understand that. I appreciate that, Representative Bowman. As the chair, just let me say that I, fully understand people's general opposition and recognize the very personal feelings that surround the ability within the state of Oregon under our aggravated murder statutes to include the imposition of the death penalty as one of the penalties, having been convicted if you are of that crime. For me, this comes back to the fundamental question which I posed when the witnesses testified on this before. We currently do statutorily sentence or have the ability to sentence for aggravated murder a person who kills a witness who is a witness in a criminal proceeding. And I can find no rational public policy distinction to differentiate between the penalty that a person should be subject to for killing a witness in a juvenile proceeding. I just can't see the distinction. And I think it creates a system of sort of odd imbalances and inconsistencies within our process. But I fully understand people's personal heartfelt and sincere opposition to the death penalty, and this is not something I take lightly. I would point out that that's not the only thing you can sentence in an aggravated murder case, but it is an option, and I recognize people's position with respect to that. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like Representative Bowman, I supported the amendment because it makes the bill better, but I'm not going to be voting for this today for many of the same reasons. I'm just morally, ethically, philosophically, every little clue you want to put on there opposed to the death penalty. And if we would just make this life in prison without the possibility of parole, I'm okay with it. And I understand your reasoning about the public policy decision, because that's it's a tough one. This, I didn't think I'd be faced with this difficult of a decision so early in the session, but the decision comes down to the fact that this person would be eligible for the death penalty. And unfortunately, on our tour of the prison the other day, I didn't know I was in the execution chamber until the last minute, and I caught a glimpse of that. And it was very, very troubling for me, and I had a difficult time recovering that day. And I understand what we're doing here. This case comes out of my county. It was egregious. They're all egregious, but I don't think the state should be in the business of killing people. I just think a better sentence is life in prison, and I can't go there on this one.
I understand. Representative Lowe.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak, although I'm not a voting member of this committee. I've been troubled by this. I hate inconsistency and strange results in the law, and had I been a voting member, I would have supported the amendment just because it's, I mean, we need to, that's part of our job, is to repair illogicalities and make the law consistent and applicable to everybody who is similarly situated. But I guess I have a policy question about this. Is it an accurate statement to say that the ABA is in the process of seeking a moratorium on the death penalty to revisit the general desirability of such a policy across the whole nation?
I understand that it is. I don't know that for a fact.
I don't know that for a fact either.
But I understand
either,
that it is.
I'm told that that is the situation, and it's, assuming that's true, and I have no reason to believe it's not, but because my source is pretty good, but assuming that's true, are we maybe out of sync with things, or taking Oregon further down a path that really does fly in the face of some of the newer and brighter thinking on this topic by expanding the death penalty? I'm just want to throw that out.
Well, I appreciate your comment, Representative Lowe. I don't view this in that light at all. And I recognize that the philosophical opposition that some people have to the death penalty and how that might play into voting on this particular statute. But again, I think this is not a hearing, and this is not a bill debating the issue of whether or not we ought to be charging or seeking the death penalty in aggravated murder cases. That's not this bill. This bill is about determining, once the issue of aggravated murder and what that potential sentence might be has already been established, which it has been, this is about whether or not in two very like circumstances someone ought to get a different result because they've killed someone. And there is no compelling public policy reason to suggest that its approach ought to be different in one murder case versus the other. I'm pleased to sit around with all of you and have a very heartfelt discussion about the impact of the death penalty. It's an issue that I personally struggle with myself, but I can't. But I think the voters of this state in prior legislatures have made that determination in Oregon, and I don't think that's what we're talking about here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a big picture thinker, when the net result of our action here is either someone dead at the hands of the state or someone not dead at the hands of the state but serving a life sentence, I have trouble compartmentalizing exactly which category our actions fit into. So I can't go down that logical path of your saying, oh, we're just only acting on consistency here.
I understand.
Dead is dead.
Any other comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I would agree that this hearing today and work session is certainly not the forum to make any great determinations about the death penalty. We all have our philosophies about that, and I think the people of our state have certainly told us what their wishes are, and I think in the name of that, we must be consistent in public policy. I think testimony bore that out, the fact that there was no compelling reason from a public policy standpoint to have two different classifications of penalties here. So with that in mind and with that thinking, I certainly support the chair's statements here and certainly intend to vote.
Thank you.
Yeah. Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
No.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Okay.
Representative
Sherman? Yes.
Representative Walker?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Yes. Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2092 will be referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry it. And with that, members, we have a short schedule today. I hope you enjoy your time off. I'm sure you have plenty to do. We have our full committee tomorrow. Mr. Taylor, can you just brief us? How many bills do we have up tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we have about 8 bills on. Now, a couple of the bills that are on, what we traditionally do is what's on Thursday, we cannot meet the 24-hour notice rule from the subcommittee. So what we traditionally do is schedule the bills that are on Thursday for full committee Friday, because we can take them off, but we can't put them on.
Right.
So it's probably about 5 or 6 bills.
5 or 6 bills. So it should be a fairly abbreviated morning, tomorrow morning as well. Thank you, committee. We now stand adjourned.